Welcome to this special spin-off interview program from a CME satellite program held at the 2017 GI Cancer Symposium in San Francisco. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with faculty member Dr. Johanna Bendel to discuss the three modules in the symposium on the management of advanced colorectal cancer. And to begin, we reviewed the case of a patient who presented with metastatic colon cancer. So the first case that we had was a 63-year-old woman who presented with a left-sided pan-RAS wild-type lesion and a single liver met. And the question is, what to do about the one liver met? So the question is, you just go ahead and take it out, or do you give pre-op chemotherapy? And, you know, it's interesting that pretty much the whole faculty would have sent the patient to surgery. And yet a lot of the audience, I'm not sure if some of it was internationally driven, would give pre-op chemo. Could you talk a little bit about the decision and what data we have to help kind of figure out what to do in this situation?
The best part about it is we don't have tons of data, so we can operate what makes us feel more comfortable. You know, initially, when the French talked a lot about surgical resection of liver lesions for colon cancer, they really insisted on giving chemotherapy preoperatively to get a sense of what the tumor was going to do in terms of response when you gave it, and then go ahead and take those areas out. You know, I think that where most of the panel thought is that if it's an easy surgery for the patient, an easy surgery for the surgeon to go ahead and get the liver lesion out, maybe it's best to do that right away and then go ahead and give the adjuvant chemotherapy. Now, there's also the European study that looked at preoperative and postoperative FOLFOX for resectable liver lesions. And so some people will base their practice just based on that type of regimen where you gave 3 months of upfront FOLFOX, then surgery, and then 3 months of outback. So I think you could go either way here.
This doc actually gave pre-op FOLFOX, in fact. The patient had an objective response, and then the lesion was removed surgically. So she chose, this Dr. Chen, to use pre-op therapy. And the question she had is what to do post-op. So we asked the audience two questions related to that. First, we said, okay, suppose what actually happened was that she got pre-op treatment. Would you give it post-op? And pretty much the audience would without a biologic. Same thing kind of for the faculty. And then we asked, well, suppose there wasn't pre-op therapy, what would you do post-op? And kind of the answers are pretty much the same. And not much use of biologic is this sort of pseudo-adjuvant situation. Again, what's the data we have on the decision and how do you see it playing out?
The biggest study we have is the European study that talked about the perioperative FOLFOX and did see an improvement in disease-free survival, not an improvement in overall survival, but that was probably because the study was more powered towards disease-free survival. And so that's what most of us base it off of. The extrapolation that we're having is that, is it perioperative better than just giving it adjuvantly? And I think most of us are extrapolating off of the adjuvant colon data in the non-metastatic setting where you give a total of 6 months of chemotherapy.
And in terms of biologic, any comment on that? I mean, we know adjuvant, at least bevacizumab, doesn't work, and cetuximab. What about pseudo-adjuvant?
Yeah, and I think what you're also seeing is that same extrapolation from the bevacizumab data for the stage 2-3 disease, where people say, well, we'll probably not use it. Now, interestingly, for patients who are borderline resectable, where you want to give something like a bigger chemotherapy regimen with a biologic to try to shrink them to get them to resection, then people will use bevacizumab in that setting based on the TRIBE data, the Olivia data, and others. But sort of straight up, I think people can leave that biologic.
So another question, and John Marshall talked about the data that's evolving on right versus left-sided lesions, and maybe we can chat a little bit about it. But from a practical clinical perspective, we had a case and we asked the audience, in a patient who has a right-sided pan-RAS wild-type lesion that's with metastatic disease, who's gotten a couple rounds of chemo slash Bev, FOLFOX, FOLFIRI, and then has disease progression, would you use an EGFR antibody? And the vast majority of the audience, as well as the faculty, would. But there are data suggesting maybe it's not going to be effective.
Yeah, so what we're seeing is the data is all in the first-line setting. So the multiple randomized phase 3 first-line trials that have looked at this have seen that the right-sided tumors have an overall poorer prognosis, which we've sort of known and not really thought about into the last few years. But then the thought that if you give a right-sided tumor an EGFR inhibitor, you probably don't get benefit from that. But all of that data is still in the first-line setting, so I think people are not quite sure that they can extrapolate that to later lines of treatment at this point.
I guess particularly because there aren't a lot of options and you want to try to use something if it can be useful. Yeah, any thoughts? You know, John was trying to speculate on why we see these differences. It looks like genomically they're different cancers. He talked about the biome, you know, the flora. I wasn't sure where he was going with that. What's your take on this right and left-sided thing? Do you think it's for real?
Oh, I definitely think it's for real. I mean, first of all, embryologically, they're different. So they're from different parts of the foregut and the hindgut and midgut when you divide up the colon. So I think that the tissue itself is different. They've looked at mutational status and where those are all located. And they're certainly distinct between the right and left side of the colon. And then the other thing, and what John was alluding to, is that there's been interesting data out of Hopkins that has looked at the bacteria in the colon and found that they're actually totally distinct between the right and the left sides, and could those be responsible for the different molecular changes that we see or the different molecular differences or patterns that we see from right versus left side of the colon? And still a lot of research to be done there.
So in the next module, Eric Van Cutsem talked about kind of beyond really second line therapy, and particularly the issue of the clinical integration of TAS-102 and regorafenib into therapy. And so we presented a situation of a patient who was 72 years old, RAS mutated metastatic colorectal cancer, who got FOLFOX Bev and then FOLFIRI Bev and now has disease progression. And interestingly, the audience was split almost exactly the same number between regorafenib and TAS-102 in this situation. Although, interestingly, the faculty, other than you, unless you want to change your answer.
I will not.
You were the only one who said TAS-102. They all said regorafenib. So, you know, I guess there's no perfect answer for this question, but I am curious, again, what data we have and why do you use TAS-102 and why do you think the faculty is using regorafenib?
Yeah, it's like great taste, less filling.
Right. Exactly.
So you've got these two drugs that both have randomized phase 3 studies in approximately the same setting, the refractory colorectal population. And they both saw about the same improvement in survival with a hazard ratio of 0.8. So which do you use first and why? There's a lot of debate about this. To me personally, why I make this decision is that to me, TAS-102 is a little bit less toxic than regorafenib in my experience with it. Main toxicity, some GI toxicity, some diarrhea, but mainly hematologic with neutropenia, some thrombocytopenia, but toxicities that I can handle. The patients have seen neutropenia before. It's something that I can get on top of pretty quickly. With regorafenib, I've gotten better at using regorafenib because I started a lower dose. We still don't know if starting at a lower dose is the right thing to do. That's being tested right now. But we want tolerability and we want quality of life, particularly in the refractory setting for these patients. And so that's why I choose TAS-102 over regorafenib. I have had an argument with Axel Grothy about this. We debated it. I remember, I think it was on your stage, where Axel tends to use the regorafenib before the TAS-102 because of its toxicity profile, thinking that we should give that to the patients when they can tolerate a potentially more toxic agent and then move into the less toxic agent later, if I'm putting words into his mouth. And so that's a reasonable approach. I just tend to use the TAS-102 first.
So one issue that came up, I guess, in the past year that's been kind of interesting with TAS-102, you mentioned the neutropenia, but it looks like, and there was actually some work presented on this, the patients who get neutropenic actually do better in terms of disease. How, you know, sort of striking to you is this correlation, and what do you think it means?
To me, it is pretty striking. So if patients got grade 3-4 neutropenia, they had the highest chance of responding to TAS-102. If they did not get neutropenia, interestingly enough, they had basically no chance of responding to TAS-102. So it really brings up the question, you know, do you need more drug to get it active? So are the patients who have that neutropenia have more exposure to drugs somehow, and is it tied into PK somehow? You know, I hate to ask this question, but do we start treating to neutropenia? Don't do that in practice. It still needs to be tested in a safe environment. But I mean, it does beg that question.
Yeah, that really is interesting. Have you seen neutropenic fevers or infection with TAS-102?
I have. You can see fever and neutropenia or neutropenic infections, but it's a relatively low rate because we're expecting the neutropenia, so we're watching for it, and we tend to get patients on prophylactic antibiotics if they need to, I think, a little bit sooner.
It kind of reminds me, we're hearing the same story with palbociclib. Your colleague Denise Yardley in breast cancer is familiar with that. It kind of seems like the same story. You see it, but it doesn't seem to be a big deal.
Yeah.
Interesting. So another question we asked, you were mentioning the issue of dose in regorafenib. Of course, that's been discussed ever since the drug came out. But we are hearing people, and what dose do you normally start at, incidentally?
So I've changed. I've modified. I don't start at 80 anymore. I start at 120 now.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. Initially, a lot of people, in the beginning, when people started to see the toxicity, everybody dropped down to 80. And now you see more people starting 120. Anyhow, we pose this pretty common scenario because a lot of people are trying 80 of the patient who gets 80 and then after the first cycle is totally fine, has no problem. And most of the audience and all of the fact that he would bump up to 120. Any thoughts about that?
Yeah, I think what you do is wherever you start, monitor the patient, education of the patient, they start to get the hand-foot syndrome, fatigue, mouth sores, anything, to call in immediately, hold their dose so you can modify it accordingly. I tend to see them weekly during that first cycle and then change the dose weekly or every other week, depending on the patient or the toxicities, to bump up as needed or bump down as needed.
So everybody would go to 120. We didn't ask, but I'm curious. If you had the patient on 120 and they were totally fine, would you go to 160?
Oh, yeah, I would. I would. I've had some of the odd patients that will just totally tolerate 160. I don't know who they are.
Interesting.
But I've had some folks that have done it.
We actually had a poster at the meeting based on a poll that we had done in the past in a meeting, and we found something kind of interesting. And amazingly enough, we saw the same exact thing here, which is, so we presented a situation of a patient, younger patient, presents with metastatic disease, pan-RAS wild type, but has a BRAF V600E mutation in the tumor. And what we've seen in the investigators is that people, most of them use FOLFOXIRI Bev for a patient like that. And what we reported in this poster, there's a bunch of things where we saw differences between docs and practice investigators. And this is one of the more striking ones, which is people weren't doing that. And lo and behold, we did the same thing at this meeting. And we said, you know, what would you use in a patient like this? And 23% said they use FOLFOXIRI Bev, all the faculty. Why is the faculty doing this? Why are you all going towards FOLFOXIRI Bev with BRAF mutant disease?
Well, I think what we've seen with BRAF mutant disease, it's a lot more aggressive than BRAF wild-type disease. And we've seen data from the TRIBE study suggesting that the subset of patients with BRAF mutation did better with FOLFOXIRI Bev than they did to doublet therapy. So I think a lot of people outside of clinical trial have moved into that more aggressive regimen.
So another question in terms of BRAF disease was the question of whether or not they use your regimen, or I think it's yours, of a BRAF
inhibitor.
You take credit for this. BRAF inhibitor, MEK inhibitor, and EGFR antibody, you know, triple treatment in a patient with advanced disease, with progressive disease. And actually, a lot of the audience wasn't even familiar with that. But of those who were, most of them would use it. All the faculty would use it. I was kind of surprised because it kind of sounds like a not very patient-friendly experience. And I wasn't really sure whether the patients are really, when you add up and risks and benefits, doing better. But seems like you all think that's the case. And I mean, it's your study. What do you think?
So, I mean, I think we do see that toxicity, primarily skin tox, between the BRAF inhibitor and the EGFR inhibitor together. You do see that. Now, we do have good drugs to help ameliorate that. We can use steroids. We can use antibiotics. And I think where this regimen came from was, again, this whole thought, the poor prognostic status of the patients with BRAF mutations. And seeing that when we give a BRAF inhibitor alone to these patients, it really doesn't do anything because there's upregulation of the EGFR pathway. So what we have to do is do multiple treatments to block both pathways to be able to have some sort of activity there. The question is, in all of these studies that have looked at BRAF inhibitors plus EGFR inhibitors plus MEK inhibitors, BRAF inhibitors plus EGFR inhibitors plus PI3 kinase inhibitors, BRAF inhibitors plus EGFR inhibitors plus chemo, you know, is the data that we see from the patients on that study going to be better than chemo alone. And so that's the big question that's happening right now, because we've seen some amazing responses, but it hasn't been 100%. And when you look at the progression-free survivals, they seem to be better, but it's not a home run. So the question is where to place these treatments in the treatment of patients with BRAF mutated disease. And so there's some studies that are ongoing now that are looking at line of therapy and whether that should take over chemotherapy in certain lines of therapy.
This triplet regimen.
Yeah.
So another sort of biologic question that kind of sneaked up on us the last couple of years has been HER2-positive metastatic colorectal cancer, which is not rare at all from what I've been told, what, maybe 5% of colon cancer or more than that?
Yeah, I mean, it's probably sitting around the BRAF mutation numbers, maybe just slightly less.
Yeah. Right. So in any event, we asked about the issue of using anti-HER therapy in patients with HER2, I guess, amplified, not mutant, but amplified colorectal cancer. And the audience was kind of all over the place in terms of trastuzumab, lapatinib, the combination, but actually only 20% of the audience gave the answer that all the faculty gave, which is the combination of trastuzumab and lapatinib. And maybe you can talk a little bit about the data that drives this and what you've seen in your own practice with this combination.
Yeah, so this is data from the Heracles study where they took patients with HER2 overexpressing colorectal cancer and they gave them trastuzumab and lapatinib and saw a wonderful response rate. I think it was like 30-40% that was long. It was very durable for these patients using that combination, and that's being studied further. And then there's also the MyPathway study where they took, this is one of these basket studies where they took patients that they found who had HER2 overexpressing cancers, not only colorectal but others as well, where they gave them trastuzumab and pertuzumab. And HER presented some data at GI ASCO this recent January where you saw about a 40% response rate, again, durable responses for these patients. And so this is begging the question, how do we take this further into development? And is this the combination or would trastuzumab alone work? There's been some anecdotal reports looking at trastuzumab alone for these patients. Again, very small numbers, very anecdotal, where they haven't seen as much response as they have with doublet therapy, whether it be lapatinib and trastuzumab or trastuzumab and pertuzumab. So the next step, I think, is actually finding more of these patients and building on the numbers that we see. And is this something that could potentially be registered?
So you discussed at the meeting the issue of checkpoint inhibitors in GI cancers, particularly patients with MSI-high colon cancer. So the first question we had was, in general, what first-line therapy right now today, theoretically, do you think anti-PD-1 or PD-L1 antibodies should be in the management of the MSI-high subset? And the audience was pretty split between first, second, and third-line therapy. Most of the faculty, including you, thought it should be used first-line. Can you talk a little bit about right now what the latest update is on this data? And maybe you can go back a little bit in terms of what MSI is and what we know about checkpoint inhibitors in these patients.
So basically microsatellite instability. So when we divide our cells, we have all of these tandem repeats in the DNA. So sometimes they're dinucleotide or trinucleotide repeats. And if you think of the machinery that replicates our DNA, literally like machinery, like a gear that's turning, when you have these di or trinucleotide repeats, it can get caught up on them. And so sometimes mistakes or breaks can happen. And so we have a machinery that goes behind the replication machinery that corrects those. So for people who are microsatellite unstable, they don't have the mismatch repair proteins that fix the mistakes that are made. So these patients are more likely to have mutations that occur. And so those folks are the ones that will more likely respond to immunotherapy because we've seen that tumors have more mutations or more mutational burden are more likely to respond to immunotherapy than others. And we've in fact seen this in colon cancer.
So I think the first data we saw was like New England Journal papers, like 11 patients. Where are we today? How many people have been reported to have been treated? And what's the working response rate idea at this point?
Yeah, so I think in terms of the publications, we may have 40 or 50 with pembrolizumab that's shown about a 30 to 40% response rate, long durable responses. We've seen some data with nivolumab, also treating these patients where they've seen the response rate probably about 20 to 30% range, again, durable responses. And then some data with nivolumab and ipilimumab showing about the same type of response rate. So our response rate has a little bit of swing in it, maybe between 30 and 50% for these patients. There's a lot more anecdotal patients being treated because we have been able to get these agents off study for patients. But certainly the clinical trials are ongoing in the first line setting as well as further line settings to see where exactly these immunotherapies should be placed for the patients who are microsatellite unstable.
And in terms of these limited data that we have right now with these patients, any data on PD-L1 levels?
So interestingly enough, with patients with colon cancer, the PD-L1 level doesn't seem to make a difference in terms of whether patients are going to respond or not, as it does with something like lung cancer or even potentially gastric cancer. There was data presented at ESMO last year of the nivolumab data that actually tried to correlate PD-L1 status and didn't see that correlation.
And so when you quoted those numbers, that's irregardless of PD-L1 level, like the pembro, because in the pembro lung study, you couldn't even get treated unless you had it.
So yeah, you only had to be microsatellite unstable.
Right, right. And that can be either somatic or germline.
Correct. We don't think that there's any difference so far in terms of responses or chance of response based on whether or not the patient's germline or somatic.
So, in terms of trying to figure out what the response rate is, for example, in your experience, how many times have you used a checkpoint inhibitor in MSI high disease and how many people responded?
Right. So I've used like 25 patients and I have, knock wood, yet to seen somebody progress right through it.
Hmm. And do most of these people have objective responses?
Most of the patients do, yes.
Hmm. Anything unusual in terms of tolerability or same thing as been seen with all the other tumors?
The same thing as seen with all the other tumors, yeah.
Again, anything to think that any of these checkpoint inhibitors are going to be any different? I don't know if any of the PD-L1 agents are being used or have used, but they seem all the same.
Yeah, I mean, so far they're all the same. The big question I think it's being posed even more in lung now is, do you use a PD-L1 inhibitor after a PD-1 inhibitor and do you see a response? It's hard to say. Different targets, maybe differences in efficacy. I think if there was, it's going to be small.
So we had a couple of clinical scenarios that we asked everybody about, including the faculty. I thought they were kind of interesting. We were trying to think about how can we structure a case scenario to kind of pull some stuff out. So the first scenario was an older patient with limited metastatic diseases, asymptomatic. So we said 76-year-old patient. So they're stable, asymptomatic, but they're MSI high. And so when we asked the audience, they were split. Most of them actually would give chemo, but then the split between whether Bev, EGFR antibody, but only a third of the audience would use a checkpoint inhibitor for a patient like that. When we asked the faculty, they were also split. So three people said checkpoint inhibitor and three said chemo. I mean, to me, if the patient's asymptomatic, maybe give them a shot to get launched into a prolonged remission, but I guess not everybody buys into that.
Yeah, no, I actually agree with using the checkpoint inhibitor in somebody who's asymptomatic. You have some time for the immunotherapy to work, and you also have some time that if, God forbid, it doesn't work, you can give chemo after that.
So another situation, we made the patient younger, so now 63, but now with extensive, moderately symptomatic disease. And the audience still was kind of split between mainly chemotherapy, either Bev or EGFR antibody. And the faculty now, I think you actually switched. Mm-hmm. Everybody else kind of stayed the same. But now you've got a symptomatic patient and you go with chemo. What are you thinking?
I'm saying that the chemo and first-line therapy is good that we have. And I'm a bit of a chicken. So, if I've got a patient who's symptomatic and I'm sure that I'm going to get a response, the responses that have been reported from the PD-1 inhibitors, they fluctuate. So if I miss my window, giving something a little bit more experimental, I'm going to feel bad. Now, ideally, if I have $1 zillion in my pocket, I'm going to give them chemo with the checkpoint inhibitor and see how that does.
So I know that's been looked at in lung and they got higher response rates, but has that been looked at with MSI high?
Not necessarily MSI high, but there was a study that's been published of FOLFOX-BEV plus PD-L1. And it was a first-line limited subset of patients still waiting for the data to mature just to see if there is a difference in how people do. But it has been shown to be safe to give. But again, don't do that at home outside of a clinical trial.
Another issue is the tolerability. You were saying that it seems like it's the way it is with other cancers. But again, we asked about with this last patient that the faculty treated, and 5 out of 6 had no problem. 1 actually had a significant problem. You know, everybody is very, I think, tuned in at this point to the weird spectrum of autoimmune things that you see. Do you go through all that stuff with the patient, then go, but most likely it's going to be totally fine? Is that what happens?
Yeah, I mean, when I talk to patients about it, I said, when you look at side effects, there are more things that you would think of where the immune system attacks the body. And so we talk about mild rashes that patients can give that are usually pretty responsive to topical steroids. We talk about hypothyroidism. I see a lot of hypothyroidism that occurs from burnout, from a thyroiditis that then burns out the thyroid. So you have to always check your thyroid levels and see how the patient is doing. And then every so often you see an autoimmune hepatitis, an autoimmune pneumonitis or a colitis, not so much as you do with like the CTLA-4 agents, but certainly it's rare, but it can happen. So we watch them pretty carefully.
So we did have a case of a patient who got a checkpoint inhibitor on an MSI-high trial who had a great response. And this particular trial that the patient was on had therapy stopped at 12 months, and so the patient's now being observed. But outside of a trial setting, how do you deal with the issue of how long to keep therapy going? I don't know if any of these people have gotten out to 2 or 3 years, but you know, you hear about this and melanoma and all. Have you encountered it yet?
Yeah, that's the hardest question to answer is when do you stop and can you stop? I mean, we have some trials that'll stop at 1 year, some trials that'll stop at 2 years, some trials that'll let people go on forever. And so we've seen some people who have stopped where it has recurred, and then we have seen some people who have stopped and they continue to do well. The concern is in some of the patients that I've had who have been on these PD-1 or PD-L1 inhibitors for long periods of time, like years, is they start to develop some more autoimmune issues. Like I have one lady that's got basically rheumatoid arthritis now.
Wow.
And so we pulse her with steroids every so often when it starts to act up, but it's very clearly a rheumatoid arthritis. And so as you get more long-term into these treatments, what does the rate of toxicity, does it change? Do you start to see other things start to present?
I've heard about issues related to the skin. Quote, you know, bothersome, but not that big a deal, but supposedly very common. Is that true?
Yeah, and it's not at all like we see with MEK inhibitors or EGFR inhibitors or things like that. It's just a mild maculopapular, itchy rash, really responsive to topical steroids. Occasionally, I've used a pulse of steroids and then it seems to go away and just resolve itself. But very commonly, it's what we call, you know, a grade 1 rash.
Any particular parts of the body?
I usually see it on the arms, on the extremities, rather than the torso, but it's been reported all over.
Another issue about MSI-high is what are the other cancers where you should think about testing for MSI-high and when?
Yeah. I mean, for certain endometrial, so that's also an indication where you can hopefully get it reimbursed by insurance. But also folks with gastric cancers, we're starting to think and seeing more data of the suggestion that the patients who are responding to the immunotherapies, a significant proportion of them are microsatellite unstable. So gastric cancers, neuroendocrine tumors, we see microsatellite instability.
So you were talking about endometrial. You basically think that everybody with endometrial cancer should be tested or everybody with metastatic disease should be tested?
I would say having these agents available, I would at this point, just like I would for colon cancer. I know it hasn't been a standard of care in the past, but just like with colon cancer, with this evolving agent that can do a lot of good for patients, I think it's worth taking a look.
But in endometrial, is it pretty much all germline or do you see somatic MSI?
You know, I would be thinking it's probably a mix as well, but also the germline.
So another clinical scenario that I thought was kind of cool that we came up with last minute was this. A patient with metastatic colorectal cancer with liver-only mets, where it could be potentially resectable if you get tumor shrinkage. So the same situation we talked about before where people get FOLFOXIRI, BEV, whatever, but the tumor's MSI high. So you need a response, and we say, okay, put aside cost and reimbursement. Would you include a checkpoint inhibitor? And the audience was kind of split 50-50 about whether they would or whether they would use it alone, but also use chemo. The audience, I like Tony Saab's answer, I don't know. We should have pushed him on that. But in any event, three of you, including you, would use a checkpoint inhibitor with chemo. And I'm curious, like, how you combine it. And then two would not use it at all in this situation.
Yeah. Yeah, this is me hedging my bets, is using everything that I can to give that patient that best response rate. So that was me sort of saying I'd probably would do that. You know, but again, the data is not there yet that you would necessarily have that improved response rate, because they just, I think part of it's that we haven't looked, particularly MSI patients, but whatever gives that patient the best chance of getting to surgical resection.
So the other thing I want to ask you about is your work looking at MSI stable colorectal cancer. And when I first heard that you were looking at a checkpoint inhibitor with a MEK inhibitor, I was like, again, looking closely, is that really true? I think that was ASCO 2000, and was that 16?
16 last year.
Right. So yeah. It was less than a year ago. So what is the biology behind this and what have you learned about it?
So the question is, why do microsatellite stable colon cancers not respond to immunotherapy? And when you look at them under the microscope, they have very little immune cells in them. They're almost what we call immune deserts. So we think that if you give a checkpoint inhibitor alone, there's no immune cells to cause a response. So they don't work for patients as single agents in microsatellite stable disease. And so MEK inhibitors preclinically, when you give them, show an increased infiltration of CD8 positive T cells into tumors, as well as increased expression of class 1 MHC. And so the thought is that if you give the MEK inhibitor plus a checkpoint inhibitor together, can you use the MEK inhibitor to make that tumor potentially responsive to the checkpoint inhibitors? And so that's what this trial looked at. It enrolled patients with RAS mutant colorectal cancer, the data that's been presented so far. And we gave them both MEK inhibitor plus a PD-L1 inhibitor. And in the we saw a response rate of 17% for the overall population. And three of the long-term responders were definitively microsatellite stable by two checks. And then one of the other ones, we don't have the tumor to be able to say yes or no to that patient. But this was the first time that we saw potentially an immune therapy working for patients with microsatellite stable disease.
And where are things moving? Seems like it's a pretty exciting lead.
Yes. So it went into a randomized phase 3 global study, which compared regorafenib to atezolizumab plus cobimetinib for refractory patients. And the study actually accrued so quickly, it's accrued 2 months ahead of time and has completed accrual at this point.
So when do you think we'll see some data?
I'm hoping in the next year or so, but we'll have to see.
Be interesting to see what happens on the regorafenib arm, you know, whether, you know, what kind of toxicity there is now that there's been a little bit of experience out there. I guess you're expecting the checkpoint alone is not going to do anything.
That's probably.
And what about toxicities? You know, MEK inhibitors we know from melanoma have a lot of kind of strange things that happen. What do you see when you use it? Is it similar dosing?
Similar dosing, it's the 60 milligram dose. And then we do see the acneiform rash. We do see some diarrhea, dry skin that goes along with the cobimetinib. We don't see necessarily, I don't think, any additive effects when you put the atezolizumab together. I mean, we see the diarrhea, but it's not an autoimmune colitis type picture. We've had some people who have had to take the dose of cobimetinib down, but in general, it's been tolerated.
So no fevers?
No fevers.
Is that the other one that does that?
Yeah, that's the dabrafenib.
What about the dermatologic issues? Easy sunburn, you have to keep people out of the sun, that kind of thing?
So you do have to watch out for sun sensitivity for these patients. So I just tell them, you know, make sure you have sunscreen on, don't go sunbathing, try to keep covered up.
Interesting. What about this strategy in other cancers? Do you think it's biologically specific to colorectal cancer, or theoretically, could it be used in other cancers?
Well, that's what everybody's very excited about, is theoretically, it could be used in any type of cancer. So we also have an arm of RAS wild-type patients with microsatellite stable colon cancer that we've used this in. We're looking at it in multiple other tumor types as well. One that's out there where the study is starting to open is a melanoma trial. And there'll be others that will, it's hopefully tumor agnostic.
And what are the other kinds of agents and strategies right now? I know this is kind of a big question, but maybe some of the ones that you think are most interesting that are being looked at to try to enhance, like the MEK inhibitor, responses to checkpoint inhibitors.
Yeah, I mean, that's the big boom right now, is how can we combine checkpoint inhibitors with other treatments? And so we've certainly seen the checkpoint plus chemotherapy data, where the thought is that if you use the chemotherapy to kill the tumor, you get more antigens presented, so the checkpoint inhibitors work better. Howard Hoekstra showed some data at GI ASCO looking at atezolizumab plus bevacizumab, so anti-angiogenic plus immune therapy, which are thought to be potentially synergistic. Then people are also using these bispecific antibodies, where you bind to something that's in the tumor on one arm, and then you bind to the CD3 receptor of the T cell on the other arm to try to pull the T cells and the tumors together. Very interesting combination therapies. You can use different antigens for different tumors. You can attack different receptors on the T cells or on other immune cells. And so I think that's a huge area of drug development right now.
Any thoughts about this issue of anti-angiogenics like Bev? I've even heard people say that maybe part of the way they work is immunologically. What's the thinking?
Well, that's the thought. So high levels of VEGF are immunosuppressive. And so we think that when tumors express high levels of VEGF, that's another sort of knock against the immune system for colon cancers. And so if we can use something like bevacizumab to block that effect, could we get more potential immune stimulation?
I next met with Dr. Bert O'Neill, and to begin, we discussed the case of a young woman who received adjuvant chemotherapy for pancreatic cancer.
The first case situation was actually a case that one of the docs had, was a 59-year-old woman who was status post-surgical removal of a T3N1 pancreatic cancer with 2 of 12 peripancreatic lymph nodes. And we asked about the question of adjuvant therapy. And what we saw in the audience is, interestingly, that the most common answer was gemcitabine, capecitabine. And in fact, that's pretty much what the faculty would utilize. Can you talk about sort of where we are today with adjuvant therapy and, I guess, the question of using this combination?
Absolutely. So I think the audience had correctly understood the SBAC4 trial, which added capecitabine to standard gemcitabine and did show an improvement in overall survival for previously resected pancreatic cancer patients. And so I think that to me would be standard of care at this point for someone I thought could tolerate combination therapy, which unfortunately isn't everyone. And I think it is important, maybe especially for surgeons, but also medical oncologists, to understand that about half of patients never get to adjuvant therapy after, especially after a Whipple procedure. And I think that while adding capecitabine was a little bit of an advance for us in terms of trying to cure this, you know, very, very difficult disease, I do think it also illustrates that combination chemotherapies are going to be better than single agents. And since patients are going to have difficulty tolerating those, we probably need to start thinking about moving that treatment up front before surgery. And to me, that's really where we need to go in the next few years.
That's interesting. So neoadjuvant therapy, what do we know about neoadjuvant therapy in pancreatic right now?
You know, some institutions have been doing neoadjuvant therapy for a long time. I think probably the best examples of people who have done it and published have been MD Anderson, Duke, a few other centers. They've done that in spite of there not being extremely effective therapies. But, you know, recently we saw some relatively small data set with FOLFIRINOX just showing that it can be done. We've been doing a study of preoperative FOLFIRINOX in patients with resectable disease at Indiana University. We're probably about 40 patients into that study right now, just to show that it's feasible, patients can tolerate it and still make it to surgery. Because I think one of the historical concerns had been that systemic therapy was so ineffective that a lot of patients would become non-resectable during the neoadjuvant period. I think that's becoming less and less true. It's also a good selection tool. If you have a patient who can't get through a few months of treatment without having progression, they probably weren't going to do well after surgery anyway. And it's an awfully big surgery to go through just to have a recurrence a few months later.
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, when I think about neoadjuvant therapy, obviously there's a ton of stuff out there about trying to convert people to resectability. But you're talking about people getting neoadjuvant therapy who appear to be resectable pre-op. That's fascinating. So the second case that we had was a 74-year-old man who presented with painless jaundice, and the workup showed a pancreatic adenocarcinoma, and the thinking was that the patient might be resectable if there were tumor shrinkage, was thought not to be resectable at that point. Actually, the patient had biliary stenting, bilirubin returned to normal, and the question we asked was, what neoadjuvant regimen would you most likely utilize? And it was interesting because the audience, although a little bit more FOLFIRINOX, almost the same number said NAB, paclitaxel, GEM. And also in our faculty, we had actually four people, including you, saying FOLFIRINOX, but a couple people also saying NAB, GEM. How do you think through this issue of this clinical situation where you need to try to get tumor shrinkage?
Well, you know, we have a tough enough time curing patients who don't have vascular involvement with this disease. I think when we look at these patients who are considered borderline resectable, these are patients who could be resected, but if they go to resection directly, are at very high risk of having a margin positive resection. And at that point, it becomes very difficult to cure those folks. So really the idea here is to try to get tumor off the vessels so that there can be a margin negative resection. How to do this at this point is still really undefined, and there aren't any randomized data sets. So, you know, if people have a preference of one regimen over another, that's okay, because none of these things have been compared head to head. I think it's a little bit akin to the situation in colon cancer where we need a response to get someone to surgery. I tend to pick the thing that I think has the highest response rate. And you know, again, comparing across trials, that would appear to be FOLFIRINOX. So if I think someone can tolerate it, that is likely to be my choice.
We talked about the issue of choice of neoadjuvant therapy, and also the same two regimens, NAB-GEM and FOLFIRINOX, are brought up in terms of choice of first-line therapy. And we know there's, you know, generally the older the patient is, the more likely they are to get NAB-GEM. But can you review that first-line therapy decision and whether any data has come out over the past year or so that sort of changes that equation at all?
I think I keep getting pushed more and more towards FOLFIRINOX, especially by series of patients with, say, borderline resectable disease who have gotten FOLFIRINOX. We went through our patients who had surgery who initially had borderline resectable disease, and a few of them actually had pathologic complete responses, and most of those patients had been treated with FOLFIRINOX. So there aren't, again, any head-to-head studies that would tell us definitively which is better, but some of these series that have come out have sort of continued to sway me towards FOLFIRINOX for a patient I think can tolerate it. Now, that said, we see good responses with GEM, nab-paclitaxel. I think it's a perfectly good regimen. And, you know, this is a situation where we're not going to cure patients, and we need to have a serious discussion with them about quality of life versus quantity. And it may be for some patients that that math would lean them strongly towards the GEM-NAB-paclitaxel combination rather than the somewhat more difficult FOLFIRINOX.
Is there an age at which you start pulling away from FOLFIRINOX?
Not a numerical age. I mean, I think we all look at people, look at what other problems they have, gauge what we think their sort of fitness is in addition to age. I have to say, I don't think I've treated anyone above 80 with FOLFIRINOX. So, but below 80, I really think I see some patients who are quite fit and sturdy who have tolerated FOLFIRINOX well. So I don't really put an age cutoff below that on patients.
So speaking of above 80, the next scenario that we asked about was a second-line scenario, and it was based on a case of an 81-year-old, otherwise healthy man who got GEM-NAB as a first-line therapy for metastatic disease and then has disease progression. We wanted to know what was second-line therapy. What we see in the audience was that the most common answer was NALIRI, although a fair number of people used FOLFOX in patients like this. In terms of the faculty, Most use Nalirri, including yourself, and a couple people, again, use FOLFOX. Again, how do you think through this decision for second-line therapy in the patient who's got NAB-GEM up front?
Sure. I chose Nalirri primarily because, you know, we have a well-powered randomized trial showing that this is better than 5-FU alone. I think it was pointed out at our symposium correctly that the data for FOLFOX are mixed. That said, before the Nalirri data were available, I'd had quite a few patients treated with second-line FOLFOX who did much better than one would expect for a second-line oxaliplatin for a second-line pancreatic cancer patient, and that sways me a little bit. I think it's not an unreasonable regimen to give. That said, Nalirri has been quite tolerable. The data are reasonable. You don't have to worry about things like neuropathy, especially if someone got a fair bit of nab-paclitaxel in the first line. So I think the 5-FU Nalirri choice is a very reasonable one.
So we asked the faculty, tell us about the last patient who you gave second-line therapy to after getting first-line nab-GEM. And interestingly, 4 of the 6 faculty, their last patient got Nalirri, including you. So kind of, you know, sort of, I don't know if you remember who your patient was, incidentally.
I do. I remember who I was thinking of. And he's one of those patients who did fairly well. He got GEM-NAB on a clinical trial with an investigational drug and then eventually progressed. Started to have a lot of problems like edema and neuropathy from the GEM-NAB combination. And so, you know, when he progressed, still having a little bit of residual neuropathy, it was a pretty easy decision to put him on the 5-FU Nalirri combination. And he's done quite nicely. He's had actually some response radiographically, has been feeling well, and has tolerated it quite nicely. So I realize that that's not all patients, but that just happened to be the most recent one I'd had.
So speaking of new areas, before we move on to gastric, I was fascinated by the discussion of a new strategy that I wasn't aware of, looking at hyaluronic acid, HA, and the recombinant human hyaluronidase, PEG, PH20. Could you talk a little bit about what it is and how it's thought to act?
Yeah, absolutely. This is another exciting potential area in pancreatic cancer. And we're here in 2017. The only approved targeted agent for pancreatic cancer is erlotinib. So we're certainly desperate for interesting strategies like this. And this one really addresses a major problem in pancreatic cancer, which is that pancreatic cancers almost lay down a barrier of cement around themselves. You know, you'll have little islands of tumor floating in all of this collagen and hyaluronin that we think really prevents drugs from getting at the tumor cells, causes, you know, high pressure within the vasculature so that drugs can't even access the vasculature there. And so this is a strategy that basically directly breaks down some of this material that forms around the cancer to try and make the cancer more accessible to drugs. So it's an enzyme. This enzyme by itself is not likely to do anything to the cancer cells, but I think there's some hope and some at least preliminary evidence that this is going to make chemotherapy work better.
And this is a pegylated compound?
That's correct. Yeah, I think since it's a protein, just to keep it from getting broken down too quickly in the circulation so it can actually get to the tumor.
And, you know, I guess we looked at some sort of early data that looks encouraging. Any tolerability issues that you're aware of?
You know, the major problem that's been seen with this has been thrombosis. And, you know, obviously that's a big problem for this patient population where thrombosis is already an issue. So at this point in time, all of the studies going on with this agent are requiring anticoagulation during treatment. Otherwise, you know, in terms of side effects that you might expect from chemotherapy, those types of things, those are not seen with the agent. Just this particular problem that we think is preventable, but is obviously a big problem.
And the strategy, though, is to combine it with chemotherapy?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
And from what you've seen, are you encouraged by the efficacy, or is it too early?
I think the problem has been patient selection. So if you look at unselected patients, there's not enough of a signal. Some tumors have more of this hyaluronin than others. It's not like a genetic mutation where we're just going to be able to get a yes-no answer about a tumor. It's going to be more like HER2 with kind of gradedness of how much hyaluronin is there. So I think it's a question of finding a cut point and figuring out what are the patients who are likely to benefit. And that's going to be difficult. It's going to require relatively large studies.
So we were talking about the issue of, you know, when a new agent comes into practice, sort of figuring out where it fits. And it's interesting for us in the CME world to sort of see how people react when new things come on board. And I remember what you were talking before about Ramucirumab in the second line, how it's proven, et cetera. And we actually asked the audience, we said, tell us about the last patient in your practice who had metastatic HER2-negative gastric cancer, who got second-line therapy after getting FOLFOX first-line. And the vast majority of these patients actually got Ramucirumab taxane, which kind of, you know, supports the concept of it coming into practice. It's interesting, when we asked the faculty, we also saw the same thing. How is Ramucirumab sort of shaken out in your own practice? Are there any situations now where you use it with other chemotherapeutic agents, for example, in a patient with a neuropathy? Do you ever use it alone?
I mean, very good question. I definitely think it's a drug that can be used alone. I frankly was very pleasantly surprised to see that a drug like this could have single agent activity in stomach cancer. It was very surprising to me. And, you know, even though the magnitude of benefit is not huge, just to see that with a VEGF receptor targeting agent for this particular cancer was pretty exciting. So if someone can't tolerate chemotherapy or really wants to preserve quality of life but wants to have some kind of treatment, I think this is a reasonable choice by itself. The other question is a harder one. So you have someone who's gotten a lot of neuropathy in first line, and you know, you don't really want to use a taxane very much. Can you combine it with something else? I have to admit, I have not done that, although the temptation to say give it with irinotecan in particular might be high. I just haven't run into that scenario myself. It, again, tends to be for the HER2-negative gastric patients that they don't stay on first-line therapy long enough to get a lot of neuropathy. It's not as much of an issue as it is in other disease situations.
Not only do we ask about the last patient, but we also asked in general what their second-line therapy is for patients, again, HER2-negative gastric cancer, for second-line therapy. And the vast majority of the audience says Ramucirumab paclitaxel. And all the faculty said that except Dr. Johanna Bendel, who's also on the same program you're on here, who would use an anti-PD-1 antibody. And that really introduces one other thing I wanted to ask you about, was the issue of checkpoint inhibitors in gastric cancer. And at the GI symposium, we actually saw a major randomized study in metastatic gastric cancer looking at nivolumab. Can you talk about what they presented there and what you think it means?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there were a few very exciting presentations at this meeting, and that was right up there. You know, possibly the most exciting was to see this very hyped, exciting class of agents actually have a positive phase 3 trial in a GI cancer. It's the first in a GI cancer. It's in a cancer that's always been very difficult, has relatively few treatment options. You see 26% of patients who are second line alive out beyond a year. I mean, that's, again, unheard of for this particular malignancy. So it looks like there's some really durable responders there. I guess the only caveat is this was a trial that was conducted entirely in Asia. So I'm not certain we could say we'd get the same results in a U.S. population, but we've certainly had trials that have included Western patients where we've seen decent response rates. So I have a suspicion that we'll see similar results in a Western population when those data come around.
So right now, you know, sort of putting the issue of whether you can get it paid for, and I'm curious to know whether you can, where do you see checkpoint inhibitors fitting into non-protocol therapy, and which checkpoint inhibitor?
Yeah, well, I think the question of which is really unaddressed at this point. I think we've seen roughly similar response rates with pembrolizumab and nivolumab, and frankly, others that haven't been approved in as many diseases as those two yet. To me, at the moment, they're really a third-line option. We have been able to get them covered for patients by insurance, by, again, company assistance. So I certainly think it's something worth going after. I do find Dr. Bendel's position interesting on this. You know, second line chemotherapy, even with ramucirumab, is still not all that appealing. So she's sort of making the bet there that immunotherapy is going to be better. But there are a lot of unanswered questions there. One is, you know, would immunotherapy be better with some chemotherapy? Can we include more patients among responders and long-term responders then? That's a question that needs to be answered. So to me, it's really for a fit third line patient, although, you know, I'm obviously looking forward to seeing it successful in first or second line, and those trials are going on as we speak.
So we're talking about new approaches to gastric cancer checkpoint inhibitors. Another that we talked about at the symposium was the issue of stem cell inhibition. Can you talk about sort of the basis for that strategy and where we are today with that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So this is another area that I think is one of the more exciting, you know, outside of immunotherapy, one of the more exciting and untapped new areas. So the idea of inhibiting cancer stem cells is that the stem cell is a subpopulation within a tumor that can self-replicate and can go on to create specialized subtypes within a tumor. It almost, it's more of an organ-like idea of what a tumor is rather than a completely clonal population. And at least preclinically, if you treat tumors with chemotherapy, you end up after you've treated with an enrichment for stem cells, suggesting that the non-stem cells are more chemotherapy sensitive and the stem cells stay behind, and then it just makes sense that they're going to repopulate the tumor. And this is why we can't cure most solid cancers with chemotherapy. So there are, appear to be a number of pathways that drive cancer cell stemness. That's very hard to say 10 times in a row. And one of them I think that's early on and very exciting is the STAT3 pathway. This STAT3 is a transcription factor. It's downstream of a number of growth factors. STAT3 inhibition preliminarily has looked very exciting, typically in combination with chemotherapy. The first of these is a drug that's called BBI-608 or napobucasin. This is now in phase 3 trials in several diseases. There have been inhibitors of various aspects of the Wnt pathway that appear to be potential players, the Notch pathway. So I think this is a very fertile area for research. And again, if the phase 2 results hold up in phase 3, I think that the napobucasin could potentially be the first of the stem cell targeting agents to actually make it to patients to approval.
What do we know about tolerability issues with these types of agents and napobucasin in particular?
Yeah, napobucasin in particular has been relatively well tolerated. Its main issue is diarrhea, which, you know, tends to be controllable. Outside of diarrhea, its AE profile is pretty modest. Mostly other GI things, some nausea, some abdominal cramping. We're not seeing hematologic toxicity with it. We're not seeing a lot of other high-grade toxicities. So it seems though it's something that we've been able to combine with gemcitabine, nab-paclitaxel, FOLFOX, FOLFIRI, FOLFIRINOX. All of those things have been combinable with this drug. So that's certainly a good start when the goal is to, you know, try to improve responses to chemotherapy. Others have had different side effect profiles. So we were working for a bit with one of the Wnt pathway inhibitors. That one ended up having some interesting side effects as well that I'm not positive have been publicized. But, you know, each of these is going to have some toxicity, but they don't seem to have chemotherapy-like toxicities for the most part.
So I want to move on and finish out talking about hepatocellular cancer that you spoke about at the symposium. And the first patient is actually a patient where there was an issue with treatment of metastatic disease. It was a 69-year-old man with Child Pugh A cirrhosis who initially had a T2N0 hepatocellular cancer and got transplant. So this patient actually developed recurrence in the liver and bone. And by the time treatment was getting ready to be started, it was a PS2, although it was, again, Child Pugh A disease, and was started on reduced dose sorafenib, 400 milligrams a day, and actually responded, did well, but had significant diarrhea to the fact that he actually had to be hospitalized. And the question the doc has is, what do? You have a patient who's responding but is having serious toxicity and will reduce dose sorafenib. How would you think through that situation?
Sure. Well, I mean, first, it's always exciting to see a response because radiographic response per se with sorafenib is very uncommon.
I know. When I saw that, I was like, wow, that's good. I don't see that every day.
You do not. But we've seen them. And I think that's a person where you definitely want to try to get them through treatment. So, you know, one strategy there is to just keep dose reducing. And to be honest, one of my patients with sort of the best and longest responses to sorafenib was someone who did have a lot of difficulty tolerating it. And eventually I had him down to one tablet every other day, and he tolerated that and stayed on that for quite some time. So for this particular patient, that would be my answer. You know, the average benefit of sorafenib is such that if a patient doesn't tolerate it well, I'm not going to push it like that. But I think that particular scenario warrants doing whatever you can to get them through it.
So a couple other questions that came up that we put out both to the faculty and the audience. One was the issue of a patient with child PUB cirrhosis and the use of sorafenib. We said it was a 60-year-old patient. The audience, most would use it, but the most common answer was 200 milligrams BID. That was the same answer most of the faculty gave. The other question was, what's your second line therapy? And of course, this is kind of changing. And we said in a patient, again, this patient who'd had problems with sorafenib, and the audience would generally go to regorafenib, but was split between whether to use the standard dose or reduced dose. But interestingly, almost the same number of people would want to use a checkpoint inhibitor. When we asked the faculty, most would use regorafenib, a couple at reduced doses and a couple people at standard doses as second line therapy. And actually, one person would use a PD-1 antibody, Dr. Marshall. First of all, getting back to the issue of sorafenib with child PUB, how do you approach dosing? And then how do you think through second line therapy?
This is a difficult clinical scenario even to begin with, forgetting about the second line for a moment. You know, a child PUB patient would not have been included in the SHARP study. The subsequent registry, the Gideon registry, suggested that average survival or median survival for patients with child PUB cirrhosis who got sorafenib was only about 4.5 months. So I think the first thing a clinician needs to do is ask him or herself, you know, am I really doing the patient a favor by giving sorafenib? That's an important question to ask. I think we all tend to do it in our younger patients and, you know, patients who look good in spite of being a child PUB cirrhotic. So when I decide to do that, I definitely reduce the dose at the outset. And I think 400 milligrams a day or 200 milligrams twice a day is a reasonable way to start there with escalation if you feel like you can. Interestingly, in the Gideon registry, the toxicity profile in the child PUBs was not that much different than it was in the child PUA patients. So I think you can argue to start at full dose, but I think we see enough problems, it's probably better to start low. Getting these folks to second line is going to be uncommon. So I'm glad the person who asked the question had such a patient, because that's, I think a lot of these patients with child PUB disease, when they progress, they're going to progress to where they really aren't good candidates for any sort of treatment. But in the situation where you have someone who kind of maintains the same liver function along with progression, I mean, I do like Dr. Marshall's idea of a checkpoint inhibitor conceptually, because it's not going to have the same kind of toxicity. Regorafenib is going to have a fairly similar toxicity profile to sorafenib. But I think that realistically, what's going to happen is regorafenib is going to get approved soon for second-line therapy, and we're going to be waiting a little more time for the checkpoint inhibitors. So probably the easier answer for people is going to be to give regorafenib, because we are going to have the randomized data, and it's going to be approved. And, you know, we're going to have this same kind of discussion with the patient about side effects and likely time, and is it worth the side effects? But certainly, again, I'd be tempted to reduce dose at the outset in a child PUB patient who was going to be treated with regorafenib.
I'd like you to talk a little bit, and you talked at the meeting about the data that we have on regorafenib as well as checkpoint inhibitors. But first, I wanted to go through the results of a question we asked to the audience, which was we wanted them to think about the last patient who got sorafenib as first-line therapy for metastatic HCC, and what happened second-line. And interestingly, I think it's really amazing, actually, 35% of these people actually got regorafenib, which is interesting. 13% got a checkpoint inhibitor as second-line therapy, and then 37% had palliative care. When we asked the faculty, actually, you said your patient got anti-PD-1 antibody. Several people said that, and the others said regorafenib. So let's talk about the data that we have right now on those two entities, regorafenib and checkpoint inhibitors, and where you think it's going to sort of shake out in terms of sequencing.
Yeah, it's, again, I think a rapidly evolving area and a pretty exciting one. So I think the biggest difference potentially between the checkpoint inhibitors and regorafenib is going to be radiographic response. And a lot of times, along with radiographic response, you get clinical improvement. So that's always nice to see, especially in a patient who's, you know, dealing with both a cancer and cirrhosis at the same time. So I think there's going to be a very strong preference, if it's approved in second line, for people to get PD-1 antibody therapy. The dilemma is there's going to be a lot of people who get a PD-1 antibody who get no benefit from it at all. And so those people are going to progress rapidly. Whereas you might imagine with regorafenib that the degree of benefit is kind of spread across a larger number of patients. So you're trading the potential for a big response against the potential for having no response at all in rapid progression. So it's hard to know where that will settle out exactly, or whether perhaps combinations of those things will be possible. But those are certainly questions to be answered by studies for the next few years.
Could you talk about the clinical research data that we have right now with regorafenib?
Yeah, I mean, this is another sort of pleasant surprise, is you got a drug that has a somewhat overlapping target profile as sorafenib. You know, I think a drug that a lot of us have the sense is a somewhat similar agent in some ways. And I frankly would not have expected a positive second-line trial in patients who failed sorafenib. So the fact that it was pretty impressive for regorafenib as a compound. Also, the fact that the benefit seen was fairly similar to what was seen in the first-line study of sorafenib is impressive. So this is a real advance. It will be interesting to see if regorafenib perhaps supplants sorafenib as a first-line choice, you know, given that. But for now, I think is a more than decent second-line option for patients who have failed sorafenib.
What was the advantage seen when regorafenib was compared to standard therapy?
Against placebo, basically, we were looking at almost 3 months. It was a similar average benefit as what was seen with sorafenib in the first line.
So it was against placebo?
Yes, correct, yeah.
Interesting. Maybe you can talk a little bit also about checkpoint inhibitors. What's the data that we have right now in terms of response rate, tolerability?
Yeah, I mean, here you're talking about a very small data set. So I think early on, there was a lot of hesitancy to go after hepatocellular carcinoma with these drugs because of uncertainties about what would happen in people who are infected with hepatitis C. What would happen to people who are infected with hepatitis B? Would they have more problems, complications? So really, you know, we've been looking at this one nivolumab study that's, you know, a decent size phase 1-2, but not a huge study. And as those data have evolved, we've certainly seen a, you know, stable response rate, looks 20%-ish. So it's a very good response rate, frankly, for hepatocellular carcinoma. It is starting to look like the uninfected group is the group that's getting the most benefit. But again, the size of that study is not really enough to make very accurate comparisons between the three main populations, the Hep B, the Hep C, and the uninfected population.
So, you know, that 20% thing seen in a lot of cancers, lung cancer, for example, but the key thing that gets people excited is duration of response, as you were talking about before. Do we have any idea at this point, or is it just way too early right now?
It's a little too early, but certainly on that study, there have been patients on for well over a year. So we know that there can be durable responses in some fraction of people. I don't think we have enough patients yet and long enough follow-up to say of those responders, what fraction of them are going to be durable responders.
Again, I don't know whether I'm an anecdote-driven doc or something, but to me, if I hear about a couple of patients, again, I start paying more attention. Have you yourself had anybody where you clearly felt they had a very, you know, useful clinical response?
Absolutely. Actually, several now. We've, you know, compared to the expected 20%, I think institutionally we've had pretty good luck with the PD-1 antibodies in HCC patients, including one patient who's had a near CR, who's now been on therapy for nearly a year, who had flat out progressed on sorafenib in multiple locations. So absolutely, we've seen kind of those responses that really get you excited about a compound. We've also got studies going on with combinations with CTLA-4 antibodies. So several different patients with good response.
You know, in various cancers, I can't even remember anymore because we talk about checkpoint inhibitors like every day, I think. But I know I've heard the concept of anti-angiogenics with checkpoint inhibitors. You know, I've heard about Bev, for example, and the idea that maybe somehow VEGF and Bev, you know, maybe even related to the immune system. What about either sorafenib or regorafenib with a checkpoint inhibitor? Is that being looked at?
I think it's going to shortly. I think there's interest in that concept. I mean, I'm not a scientist and maybe I'm a little bit of a skeptic, but it seems as though for any agent that's not a PD-1 antibody, someone can think of a reason why it would work best with a PD-1 antibody. So, you know, it is easy to get a little bit skeptical, but I think the VEGF story preclinically seems to be an interesting one. I'm not sure it's as strong as some other combination stories, but again, part of the desire to combine is if we always give things sequentially, especially in a patient population like the HCC population, you're going to have a lot of dropout between lines of people who just can't tolerate therapy after they've failed one line. So even if there's not a biologic rationale for combining these, they will be combinable from a side effect standpoint. And I think just getting as many responses as you can in a given line of therapy is likely to be beneficial for the population.
Well, you're not a scientist and I'm not a clinical researcher, but I have my pet-like theories. And what, here's something that I think would be, I don't know, I think it would be interesting. And again, I wonder whether there's been any talk about it. You know, you hear about the abscopal effect, you know, somehow dislodging antigens or something from radiation therapy. I was wondering if there's any interest in looking at intrahepatic chemo radiation or spheres or whatever, plus checkpoint inhibitors.
Well, I'm glad you asked. It gives me a chance to,
to
be a self-promoter. We're just getting ready to start a study just like that.
Really?
With yttrium-90 and pembrolizumab.
So. No kidding. Wow.
Yeah, I agree with you. That's an exciting area of biology.
That's great.
Yeah, I'm hoping we'll get first patient on in a couple months.
Here. Wow, that's cool. So maybe you could speculate a little bit about sort of the theoretical rationale for why HCC might respond to checkpoint inhibitors. You hear things about mutational load. Obviously, there's the issue of viruses. You know, I think it's really weird in head and neck cancer that HPV negative and positive both seem to respond. So I don't know what the theme is, but any theories about HCC in terms of what's going on?
I would have thought virus infection would have been a good trigger to create antigens. If the current trend holds up that the uninfected patients have higher response rates, and that's obviously going to throw that idea out the window. HCC is not a disease with a high mutational load, generally speaking, so we can't explain it there. You know, I think figuring out who this 20% is, it's not obvious to me right now. It's going to take some work to understand that better.
What do you see in terms of PD-1 levels in HCC?
I think the rates are similar to other diseases. Probably about a third are PD-1 positive. Again, it kind of depends on your cutoff. You know, you're calling it 1% or 5%. Are you looking at tumor-infiltrating lymphocytes? I think our data set is probably a little too small right now. The trial that was updated at the GI symposium was one that did not require patients to be PD-1 positive. So the nice thing about a study that does that is you screen a bunch of patients and you figure out what the PD positivity rate is. So we'll get some idea from this because we'll see those data eventually, but I don't know that answer right now accurately.
This concludes our program, and we should note that subsequent to this recording, regorafenib was approved for the treatment of hepatocellular cancer in patients previously treated with sorafenib. Special thanks to our faculty, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for this special spin-off interview program from a CME Satellite Symposium held at the 2017 GI Cancer Symposium in San Francisco.